And the topic today is what I call e-learning 2.0, and I'll begin by pointing out that e-learning 2.0 isn't a widely used term. It's a term that I've used. It's one that I've borrowed from other places, but you know, it's not something that you find in textbooks or even canonical discussions of e-learning. And really, it's intended simply as a phrase to capture a certain approach or a certain methodology of e-learning. George Siemens, for example, would represent very much the same sort of content under the heading of connectivism. And we'll talk a bit about connectivism as well. And where this begins, there are different ways to begin. I gave a very similar talk at the OCRI conference just across the river a couple of days ago, and I began there talking about the changing nature of knowledge and how knowledge is something that is more distributed, is more of a network phenomenon, and that's one way of approaching this discussion, and I'll touch on that a little bit. For this discussion, I'll focus a little bit more on the audience, the people that we are trying to reach with e-learning. And that's classed typically under the heading of what's called the millennials. And there are different names for it. Everybody represents the, well, not everybody, but many people represent the millennials as a generational sort of thing. And I want to disavow people of that right from the outset. I was thinking about this the other day, and if I had to characterize the millennials, I'd characterize it more as a demographics thing than as an age or generational thing, because what makes the millennials is the fact that they have basically grown up with technology. They have grown up immersed in a multimedia communications environment. So, you know, they're born with a cell phone on their ear. But obviously, even today, a great number of people are not born into that environment. And also, obviously, people who are not of the younger generation were still, nonetheless, born in a technological environment. I grew up the son of a telephone worker. And for the most part, I grew up just south of Ottawa here, and my father would drive in every day and work at, well, first on O'Connor Street and then the Bell Canada down on Bank Street. So I grew up with, you know, equipment and pieces of things and telephones and parts, and so I was into this computer environment from a very early date. The characteristics of the millennial are well documented and well known, and I've sketched a few of them there. They simply assume that the technology that they need will be present. And a millennial walking into this room, for example, to do a talk like this would assume that there's internet, preferably wireless, but at the very least, as we have Ethernet, they would assume that there is recording facilities, all of those sorts of things that they need in order to be online, to connect. A millennial in this talk, and it's interesting looking at this group, a millennial would be the person at the back of the room, computer on, hooked up to the internet, reading their email while I give the talk. And if I'm lucky, they're not listening to their iPod as well. It's the multitasking thing, and I really annoy people because, you know, I do other things when I'm you know, at a meeting or listening to a talk or even giving a talk. Sometimes I might be checking my email, looking what's on the web. This is typical practice for a millennial. They'll have a number of streams of information happening at the same time. And my view, and I don't see this characterized a whole lot, but my view is that although it's depicted as multitasking, although you see this as multiple streams, I think it's important to keep in mind that these streams relate each other. You've all heard the idea of like having a soundtrack to your life or things like that. That's what happens when you have two streams, a music stream and a life stream, if you will, and they interact. The one influences the other. So, you know, if I'm getting up a good head of steam and I'm writing something, I'm going to have Neil Young blaring in the background because I want that influence in what I'm writing. And that's fairly characteristic. Twitch speed is one of those cliches to refer to the idea that millennials expect things right away, which is why I'm sort of picky about, you know, the presentation has to go up today, because that's an aspect of the millennial approach. A presentation that goes up today is worth something. If it goes up tomorrow, it's worth less because it's old news. When they send an inquiry, and you've heard this before, you know, they expect a response within a few hours. Actually, if it's email, they expect a response right away, and they really begin to wonder if they don't get it within a few hours. And if it's more than 24 hours, they think you don't care. And there's also I sometimes characterize it as disintermediation, where the millennials will tend to go directly to the source rather than rely on intermediaries. I say institutions irrelevant, and of course that's not true, strictly speaking. You know, they still want police and things like that, but they're less likely to rely on them. They're certainly less likely to think of them as authoritative. They will think of information or content coming from institutions as one of a set of multiple streams of information, and they'll evaluate it on that basis. A lot of people have talked about the millennials, Mark Prensky, what's her name, just wrote an EDUCAUSE review. Is it Diane Lorillard? Yeah. Anyhow, she also wrote a lengthy article on the millennials. So, if you do, if you look up on Google, you'll find quite a bit of background information on this. The millennials are emerging onto the scene in an environment characterized by a number of trends, and these trends were captured in a snapshot in a volume called Clue Train Manifesto. That's from, I think it was 1999 or something like that. How many of you have heard of Clue Train? One, two? Okay. The rest of you, I do recommend looking this up. It is a book, but there is a website which is actually the original. The book came much later and was kind of like the marketing of Clue Train. The short slogan form of this, of Clue Train, is, and I quote, markets are conversations. And the longer version of it is that the traditional barrier between producer and consumer, professional and clients, government and citizen, these barriers are breaking down. And they're breaking down in the sense that the flow of management and information is no longer in a single direction, but now it works both ways. A millennial, for example, in this sort of environment, would expect to have some measure of control over the production of a product, the design and the production of a product. And so you see already some companies are putting themselves online and opening up a space where their customers can help design the next product. Most recently, the Manchester Guardian went through an online redesign just in the last week or so. And one of the things that they did a bunch of things, but one of the things that they did was they decided to drop Doonesbury. But what the Guardian did is they opened up this space where their readers could, it was almost like a beta version of the redesign, and one of the things that the readers did was to get Doonesbury reinstated. But the idea here is that the design, the new design of the Guardian, is as much a product of the readers as it is the designers. This carries over to learning. And in learning, we think of, we express this under the general heading of learner-centered design. And there are 8 million ways of describing learner-centered design. I still remember having an argument with David Merrill about this, because learner-centered design from one way or one perspective might be, well, you have your course, you have your program, your content, all of that set, and you let the learner decide whether to use pictures or words or video or whatever. But I think that what we will see increasingly is learner-centered design in which the learner assumes an increasingly important role, not only in the design of the learning, but actually the selection of the learning itself. And here I'm talking about not just a non-linear presentation of material, but the whole question of whether this material, rather than some other material, will be selected. It's the sort of thing you can get into long, involved discussions with curriculum design people about this, because they'll come along and they'll say, well, that's all very fine, but if you leave all the decisions in the hands of the students, they will make very bad decisions. They won't study math, they won't study reading, things like that, these foundational things. And I was at a conference one time, and the person in the crowd said, you have to have the basics, right? You have to have the absolute fundamentals. Reading, mathematics, theology. And all the Canadians in the crowd kind of looked at him. I mean, there's a question of what counts as basic, what counts as fundamental, and we think we've got it, but at the same time, if we cling to these foundations after a time when they're no longer foundations, then we're doing more harm than good. The idea that I express here, and now this is the extreme form of the idea, there'll be all kinds of shades of gray in between, but the idea here is that the approach to education is such that students are encouraged to identify and pursue those projects, those topics, those things that already interest them. So if they're interested in playing violin, that's where they're encouraged to pursue their work. If they're interested, me, I loved maps when I was a kid, so I would have been steered toward cartography and geography and things like that. And the idea of foundational knowledge is, and Seymour Papert expressed this in Quebec about a year and a half ago, if it is indeed foundational, then the student will find that they need to acquire this knowledge in order to pursue that which they are pursuing. And more to the point, when they are pursuing this foundational knowledge, be it math, writing, whatever, they will be doing it at a point of interest and need. And therefore, it will be much more likely to be thought of as relevant and much more likely to be remembered. How many of you studied trigonometry in high school? How many of you use it? How many of you thought there would be any reason for it? See, I studied interesting high school experiences. I ended up studying trigonometry four times in different grades, in high school and in college and then again in university. And the time I actually learned it was when I was just playing around my computer trying to design Star Trek games, because I love Star Trek games. And one of the things you want to be able to do is rotate objects in three-dimensional space. You can't do that without trigonometry. You can't create a two-dimensional view of a 3D object rotating in space without trig. So there I am on my vacation, Christmas time, working on my computer, my brand new copy of Turbo C. There's my trig book sitting on my desk. Who would have figured? I mentioned George Simmons' connectivism. I don't think he quite likes this formulation, but I like this formulation. Connectivism is, in my view, a theory of the pedagogy of learning in a network environment. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by network environment as this presentation goes on. But the idea here is that instead of having a view of knowledge as a collection of discrete facts or discrete propositions, instead of having a view of learning as the transfer of those bits of discrete knowledge or discrete facts, both knowledge and learning reside in a network. And that's a hard concept, and it's a miserable concept to explain. And quite literally, a piece of knowledge, if you will, is not actually located in any single place. And George actually, he goes very social on us, but not inaccurately. He takes it a bit further than I would, but still. A piece of knowledge does not actually reside even in an individual person. And the example that I use when I try to express this concept is the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from London to New York. And if you ask yourself, what person has this knowledge? And you examine people in the aviation industry, you understand that no person has this knowledge. The pilot has one bit of it. The person who built the tires has another bit of it. The person who designed the navigation system has another bit of it. And the knowledge of how to do this is actually spread out in a network, and that it becomes crucial then that we understand this knowledge as something that not only exists in these discrete locations, but also in the nature and the structure of the connections between these locations. Because if the pilot isn't able to communicate with the navigator, that knowledge actually quite literally does not exist. The thing is, all knowledge is like this, not just complicated knowledge. Think about the concept of Paris. And I mean that quite literally. Think of Paris. Your thought of Paris isn't just of the city in France. You have all kinds of different associations of it, different understandings of it, right? In your mind, your thought of Paris quite literally is the association, the connection between a variety of mental states, but I don't want to say it that way, a variety of perceptual experiences, a variety of brain states, if you badly expressed. But the idea here is that the concept Paris in your mind is actually the collection of the concept of the Eiffel Tower that you may have seen in a picture, the concept of having seen Paris Hilton on a poster somewhere, the concept of somebody once explaining to you plaster of Paris. All of these things, all connected together, form your image of Paris. And this concept of Paris for each of you is different. Your impression of Paris, your when you think of Paris, what you think of is literally different than yours. And that's why our understanding of knowledge and learning changes when we get ourselves explicitly into a network like this. Because the idea that there is some fact, some bit of truth, some knowledge that we're transferring from one person to the other, quite literally does not make sense when no two people have in common even the most basic concepts. And what these things become is sort of, well, maybe they'll overlap just enough for us to get along together and not kill each other. But the idea that we have the same thought doesn't make sense. And again, think about a sentence like Paris is the capital of France, right? All of you know that, right? Just checking. But where does that knowledge reside? Because if you analyze it, philosophers analyze, right? This simple thing, Paris is the capital of France, is a very complex entity. Think of the phrase capital. Right. What is it for something to be a capital? Right. What is it for a country to have a capital? What's the relationship between cities and countries that a city can be the capital of a country? How do we distinguish in our own mind when we say Paris is the capital of France that we're talking about a city and not some amount of money, as in $43 is the capital of France? All of that happens, and it's based on our understanding of the language, but our understanding of the language does not reside just in ourselves. Wittgenstein would say there can be no private language. And so even our understanding of capital depends on our connection with and interactions with a community of language speakers. And so the whole idea that we're simply transferring one thing to another, one bit of knowledge to another person, makes no sense in this context. And actually, I'm very sensitive that I'm speaking to heritage community and virtual museum community, and I think that if any community would understand this, would grasp this, it would be this community. Thinking of an archaeological dig, for example, you pull out a little piece of what looks like rock, and it's sort of shaped like this, and you understand that thing a certain way because it appears to you in the context of a certain environment, and your looking at it occurs in the context of your understanding of a certain cultural perspective, a certain framework. And that is not contained strictly and solely in yourself, but in the community's understanding of that cultural framework, and then your particular take on it.
I think you're raising a very interesting point, and you know, some of the dimension that we're looking at clearly is that we want to look beyond just the presentation of facts.
Sure.
Looking at how do we create connectivity, how do we create that interactivity, because I think you put your finger on it. Really, knowledge is an equation of debate, discussions, explanations. It's interactivity and connectivity that raises that knowledge. And knowledge is not even static. It's evolving.
Right.
We know now as knowledge maybe evolved in a year time. So hence that connectivism is a very important dimension, I think, going forward and what we're looking at.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a digression, but I think it relates directly to the point that you're raising. One of the ways that I express this is that I say, with the advent of these new communications technologies, that people like the millennials, although not necessarily exclusively the millennials, are in fact adapting a new language. They're creating a new language. And this language is not a set of symbols and signs. It's not linguistic in the way that we normally understand language, but rather it's a post-linguistic and yet sub-symbolic language. The entities, the rough analogy of words in this language, are what might be called artifacts. I sometimes say they are learning objects if I'm talking to a group of educators. I sometimes say they are multimedia objects if I'm talking to designers. But basically what they are well, online especially, they're digital artifacts that are treated, used in the same way that words are to a literate speaker of a language. And so the picture that you want to have in mind then is that these learning objects, these artifacts that are being put into the domain of these internet users, they become words in their vocabulary. And so we need to understand them in a very different way. It's no longer us presenting something to them. It's more like us putting things that they can use into a sandbox in front of them with the full expectation that they are now going to use these things in order to communicate their thoughts.
It's absolutely tempting. It's such a freedom that it's almost frightening. I think, and my point here is that this freedom, this connectivity, the tools, also imply a lot of responsibility from us developing ourselves in this environment. And very recently, somebody pointed out to our attention a new production called EPIC. Have you seen that?
EPIC?
EPIC. It's kind of reaction to Google. It's a vision.
Oh, Google to 2025 or whatever, Google, Amazon, whatever. Yeah, okay, I have seen that.
So this freedom implies, and I'm connecting it to what you talked about, fundamentals. I think that these fundamentals are very important to know in order to build such an environment, because these are new types of ethics, of relationships,
yes,
of literacy.
Absolutely.
So, and we don't know yet the fundamentals. And we're trying to build something. So here, maybe you can tell us a bit more from your experience.
I agree. Did you have a comment as well?
I had a different comment. I think that's a very good question to come, you know, to reflect on. My comment is really going into the first part of the presentation that you made, which was quite interesting, because you, and it's part of what we're reflecting on going forward, is to say, again, we're looking beyond just presentation of facts. We're looking at enabling connectivity. We're looking at enabling, moving away from this learning object, let's call it reusable, high-quality content that the public can interact with, whether, you know, educators can link them to their lesson plans or students can use that information. My question is a little larger, and maybe part of the discussion perhaps, is that since we know that we have to provide high-quality content, reusable content for the public to use, what would be the success criteria for that content that we can provide to the public? We know that the public is saying, don't give me a linear presentation because I want to determine what I want to learn and extract that information, combine it to suit my needs. And I think we're all experiencing it,
sure,
at home, at something, the way we interact with the internet, with the way we find that. But you know, what would be those success criteria in that content or reusable content that we can provide to the public?
The slogan form of the answer would be that they use it. Mm-hmm. Right. And not simply, and I've had this discussion with online journalists, because online journalists are very interested in metrics. And it's not simply that they look at it, because they look at so much things every day. So much stuff goes by their eyes. Each individual item becomes irrelevant almost. But do they use it? Do they pick it up and make it part of their language? Does it form part of what they're saying? If it's, say, a digital image, do they link to it? Do they put it in their presentations? Do they do things with it? Do they take the image and put little mustaches on all the people? Do they take the image, because people do that, it's like the famous WTC guy, you may have seen this, it's kind of macabre, but it's typical of the internet. Before 9/11, some tourist, he's sometimes known on the internet now as Tourist Guy, because nobody knows who he is. There's a picture of him standing on top of the World Trade Center. That's fine. Well, somebody, after 9/11, somebody comes along and uses Photoshop and cuts and pastes the airplane into the background. So that's pretty mean. But is this concept culturally a success? Yes. Not simply because people looked at this picture, and not even simply because people took this picture, but because they took WTC guy, the guy himself, right, abstracted him from the background, and then the next one that came out is WTC guy, and he's got his backpack and all of that, and in the background is the crash of the Hindenburg, and then WTC guy at, in front of a volcano, and WTC guy in San Francisco 1906, and so that image, that concept propagated, and it propagated through a process of being not simply reused, but remixed, repurposed, and then these things becoming part of it. And so what is the success factor? The success factor in the first instance, and I'm giving you the 10-minute version here, I think, is in the first instance a measurement of how much a given production is actually used by the people that it's intended for. That brings us to David Wiley's paradox. And Wiley's paradox is essentially the more complete, the more pedagogically perfect, the more structured a given resource is, the less reusable it is. Now, it's not going to be a complete straight line because some very complex things can achieve that level of reuse. And so, you know, sometimes they surmount that paradox. The one that strikes me is the ASCII rendition of Star Wars. Some of you may have seen it. Somebody, and they're still working on it, they've been at this for like years, they're creating little ASCII pictures of the entire Star Wars movie. And that's not something you can really reuse because, you know, it's a very structured entity. You know, very linear, in fact. The only thing you can do with it, really, is watch it from beginning to end. Nonetheless, I think it does achieve a significant degree of success because it is widely linked to. It is widely known. It is widely talked about. That kind of form is emulated by other people. So, you know, it's Wiley's paradox doesn't hold strictly, but nonetheless, a simple artifact is more like a picture or a piece of text or whatever is more likely to be repurposed, remixed, reused. Audio is brilliant for that. People are remixing audio all the time. You've heard of mashups and things like that. The more complicated things, a lot harder to reuse, but I think that, you know, if we're just quantifying this, each reuse would count for more because it takes more effort. It takes more effort to reuse it. It takes more effort to understand what went into it and deconstruct that and adapt it to some other purpose. So that would be probably the quick answer. Does that make
sense? Simplicity of the content that we provide. And then how
that's a long, long discussion.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Absolutely.
I think Stephen...
No. Go ahead.
I think, Stephen, you also touched it at the beginning when you, I share also the student-centered design, the student-centered.
Sure.
I think this is it. The student-centered, that means it's, the design itself encourages the student to use it and be responsible for the learning of what they use. And I think if we succeed in doing that, we will our product will be successful.
Go ahead.
If we use your this connectivity theory, the whole word center should be a meaning.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The whole word
center.
Center. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I use the phrase learner centered because it's a nice hook.
If we design,
absolutely.
The design is a knowledge and the relationship. It's an interface between diversity.
Absolutely. I think when you say the word centered should be eliminated, you've hit the nail on the head. But that's a really, really hard concept to envision because, yeah, you are creating a network, a structure of interrelated entities, and the hard thing, of course, is drawing that out, making those relations clear. And part of this talk is the technical stuff underlying that, how you do it, right? You know the squiggles and arrows and things that make that happen. And that, on the internet, is very much in flux. But, yeah, it's a multi-dimensional, multi-layered structure of interrelated artifacts and their use by interrelated communities of people. I'm really glad you said that because it stimulates a nice picture of what we're looking at.
But don't you think, I mean, the center thing, it's Carl Rogers, you know, the famous educator who really believed in student center, meaning that the student takes responsibility of learning. It's not the teacher who imposes learning on them. Therefore, if we create some kind of a product that is very enticing for them to use, therefore, they will be responsible to learn, and the product or whatever we produce as far as information will be successful in that sense.
Well, when you say responsible to learn, what do you mean by that?
That means I want to learn. therefore, and I think it's the goal of every teacher, every educator, is to transmit the will of learning to the students. We want to have students go to our site and enjoy it and really learn, maybe without even, like you said, trigonometry. Mm-hmm. If you learn it because you need it in order to be able to do something that you like, therefore, you know, you become responsible for that learning yourself, and you will learn. But if they are imposed to go to the site, and, you know, this is part of school, they'll only go there just for the school time.
Sure.
We want to make them lifelong learner. I mean, the student one day will be part of this society, and the more educated, and we want them to, we want to give them the will and also entice them to learn for life.
That reminds me of the Wyville site, where they have, it was intended to teach math concepts to, I don't know if you're familiar with Wyville, it was created to teach math concepts to teenage girls who, they, in their studies, they found were not interested in learning math. So they created this site that people earn money, they build buildings, they own stores, they can go shopping. The one that sticks in my mind, though, that you reminded me of is Nini's Dance Studio. And it's teaching some complicated physics concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But the students don't think, oh, I'm learning this, whatever
sure.
the physics concept is. They're going into this dance studio. So that idea that they're learning, but nobody has plunked them down and said, okay, here, now learn about
right.
physics.
But the key thing here is they're not being forced to go into the dance studio either,
no.
because that would defeat the whole purpose, and that actually puts a greater distance between what they're supposed to learn and what they're doing. So, yeah. Say, I asked, you know, what do you mean by responsible? Because there are lots of talk about learner-centered, but most, if not all, of the discussion that I see is. Could be phrased under the heading of learner-centered but, and then after the but is the element of control that comes in. And certainly, you look at younger kids, you know, 5-6-year-olds, and, technically speaking, they're not mentally competent, and you don't want them running aircraft carriers and things like that. So there is going to be a but. But there are different ways of approaching that, and my approach has always been to give them the maximal latitude of choice to pursue their own interests in their own way.
And I think it's very, very interesting, because that's, you know, somewhat what we're all reflecting on, that is, you know, the difference between telling them part of the story,
mm-hmm.
or say, basically, here is basic information.
Voilà.
You tell your story the way you see it.
Sure.
Build on it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what we're trying to enable as part of that, that space.
They become responsible, and therefore, they're in charge, and they go
right.
and acquire more knowledge. And that's not only for school, it's for life.
Right.
And that's the trick, isn't it?
That's the trick. The real trick is making that true of life.
Voilà.
Because... there is that element to all of this. Is, to a large degree, many people are not in control of their own life. And if we can move this way in education, if we can move this way in communication and the construction of thought and meaning in a person's mind, then that enables that person to be more in control of their own life, to set their own directions, as they say, more authentically. But now we're drifting a bit. Which is fine, we're okay to drift for a bit, but it's different when I drift and from when you drift. When I drift, it's just an off-topic rant. What makes this work... And what's really important, and I know you guys, especially in your particular industry, are up to your ears in this, and there's no way around it. I mean, I wish there was. I would just wave my hand and make it all go away, but there isn't. But it being a network, the artifacts being elements of a language, the question of openness or control of these artifacts assumes a primary importance. Now, what we are seeing, and this is empirically the case, not simply, you know, I think it ought to be the case, but what we are seeing empirically is in people who live and work in this structure, in the millennials, if you will, we are seeing a trend toward openness and reuse, because it doesn't work otherwise, right? Openness as expressed explicitly in free and open software, and as Richard Stallman always used to say, you know, it's not free as in beer, it's free as in freedom. The idea of open source software is not that it's cheap or free. The idea of open source software is that when you get the software and you don't like the way it does something, like I don't like the way Windows crashes my computer, you can go into the software and change it and make it do what you want. It's free in that way. The software becomes not something that does something to your computer, but it becomes the tool by which you do things with your computer. It's a change of mindset. You control the software rather than the software controlling you. And that's the fundamental push behind open source. Open content is a similar thing. I'm sure many of you have, probably all of you, have heard of Creative Commons licensing. Is that correct? That's good. But again, the concept here is that it's not just because people can have free stuff, but the idea is that they can have access to stuff that they can then turn around and do things with. The thing they might just do is read it. But, you know, you think about it, your relation to content changes when it is free and open like that. One of the things, and I'm just making up this thought right now, so it might be a little off, but one of the things, if you have access to free content, you can throw it out. You can disregard it. You can think of it as uninteresting. It comes in, doesn't catch your eye. Okay, whatever. It's gone. You haven't invested money into it. So you have the freedom not simply to read, to work with content, but the freedom to think of content as, in fact, not important. It's, you know, like, you ever go to a bookstore and of course you're buying books and all you've got to work with is the picture on the cover, which is completely unrepresentative, and then the description on the back, which is an outright lie, and you open the book and you start to read it and you realize it isn't really very good. But you've invested, well, these days paperback prices, $10-$15 in this book. And you're not going to throw it away after one page. But if you paid nothing for the book, now, all of a sudden, your relation with that content is different. Yeah, I've just thought of that now, so I don't know how far that goes. The main point here is that in this environment, there is an expectation, a belief, that the natural order of things is that content is free. Content is not simply free, but it is freely shareable, freely reusable. And I know everybody's aware of the Napster lawsuits and all of that. And the interesting thing is, despite the Napster lawsuits, file sharing of music files continues to increase. It moves to new venues. Every time, you know, they shut down Napster, they went to Nutella. They shut down Nutella or Kazaa, they go to other networks. File sharing is an established fact. And it's not going to change. There's a very famous paper called the Microsoft Darknet paper, in which a couple of Microsoft engineers concluded that there is no technical way to stop file sharing, period. And the reason for that, the way I express the reason, is what I call the analog gap. And what the analog gap is, very simply, at some point, for content to be of any use whatsoever, or of any value whatsoever, it's got to get into a human brain. And to get into a human brain, it has to, at some point, leave the digital realm and go through the analog realm. This image has to travel as photons into my eyes. That sound has to travel as sound waves into my ears. There's no escaping that. That is the point at which all content is vulnerable. It's not encrypted, it's not encoded, it's not anything. It's in fact in complete human consumable form. And unless, as long as that analog gap remains, all content is copyable. I know you're about to leave, so to speak, very gently.
Are you having a discussion at lunch, or how is it?
Yes, we're going to bed.
Okay.
Are you available to...
So the session will end at what time? Sometime between 11:30 and... So shall I come back here at...
I'll be here as long as I'm needed for the day, up until no later than 5. So.
Sounds good. Okay.
Great.
See you later.
Some snags, the empty seat. Not even out of the room. His seat's still warm. All right.
Question,
yes,
for you while you look for another slide. If we want to have, you know, less of a passive learner, more active, which is where we're heading,
mm-hmm.
The idea of sharing power, it's no longer like I'm sitting in this classroom and the teacher teaches me thing and I sit down silently and I absorb and whatever remains, remains.
Mm-hmm.
This time is that the teacher has to share their power with the student, and the student themselves are actively learning through doing stuff.
Right.
So that's basically the philosophy.
And then the choice of what they are doing, indeed, even lies with the student.
You will go that far.
Well, absolutely. Because I don't want to do things I'm not interested in. And I went through that, right? You know, I was going to say piano lessons, but we never had piano, so I never went through that. But phys ed classes in school, right? I did lots of things. I played hockey. I played road hockey. I played really vicious road hockey. On icy streets when I was a kid. But what I did not like is phys ed classes. Phys ed class is like this empty hour of uselessness in my life, because it was doing things, but it was not doing things that I was even remotely interested in. To this day, I have utterly no interest in basketball. Never will. But you know, basketball, they love basketball phys ed class because it's indoors, it's controlled, you don't need a lot of things. So, I think, I think sports is a good example. You want to encourage people to do sports, or if somebody's inclined to do sports, they ought at least to be able to pick their own sport, it seems to me. And so my line here would be, if the kid likes hockey, let him play hockey. If he'd rather curl, that's cool too. And take it from there. And the fundamentals of sport will express themselves through the pursuit of that sport. Me, my sport? Darts. You think darts? Darts. You think what kind of sport is that, right? Your first reaction, if I went in and spent my hour in gym class playing darts, your typical gym teacher is going to say, oh. But at a certain point, the pursuit of excellence in darts becomes as physical as the pursuit of excellence in any other sport. And I'm sitting there at home realizing, wait a sec, I'm doing weights for my dart game. And you never, ever would have got me doing weights for anything. certainly not basketball. Two weights for a basketball? Are you crazy? I don't even want to do basketball. I'm not going to actually try to get better at it. There I am, get my weights for darts. Who would believe it? So, yeah, that's the approach that I take. We've got 10:35 here. I've got more if you want more, or whatever we can. I would certainly recommend a break, because I don't recommend any session lasting longer than an hour in any case, because that's about where my tolerance hits, and especially if I'm in an audience. That doesn't mean we can't resume after a break if you would like that. If you have other things to do, that's cool too. But I'm less than a quarter of the way through the slides.
I noticed that, because I'm familiar with this.
it's a set of slides I've used before. I feel a bit guilty, but then I was asked to do e-learning 2.0, and I have a slideshow called e-learning 2.0, and I was thinking, really silly to make another slideshow that would be identical to the first.
No, I actually wanted to hear your commentary on
that. Okay, well, that's good. So does that sound cool? I'll take, I don't know,
when
10,
do you
15?
Want us back? 10 minutes?
Right. When do you guys want to come back?
Learner-centered, thank you. Yes, we are responsible for this one. You're sharing your power with us.
Right. Well, I have no power.
You think?
My only power is over my creation.
That's right.
10 minutes.
Okay.
All right.
So who should be back in, 10 to...
10 to 11. All right, that sounds cool.
Okay, we will, Wendy. See you.
Bye.